You're listening to the Evolution Podcast, where we dive deep into the leadership practices and concepts that drive startups and other highly dynamic businesses. I'm Matt Oren, co-founder and managing director of Evolution, and an executive coach that guides leaders in fast-growing companies. Join me and my team as we speak with executives and other experts about modern methods to achieve long-term sustainable success. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Evolution Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Miriam Maima, managing partner at Evolution. Miriam has been a coach and facilitator for more than 20 years, having supported leadership development strategies at Slack, Twitter, LinkedIn, Hims & Hers, Glassdoor, Glossier, and hundreds of startups of all sizes across industries and regions. She has closely studied the overlap between business and psychology in an effort to learn how to support her clients in finding simple ways to be authentic and effective simultaneously. Miriam, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you, Matt.
Well, I have definitely been looking forward to this. You know, we've known each other for many years. Just going to put it right out there. I think very highly of you as a human and as a practitioner. And in many ways, you have one of the most diverse perspectives, I think, across clients, given your journey both at Evolution. You were a consultant before in organizations. You've done a lot of diverse work. So both individual work, team work, you've worked in leadership development, building kind of leadership development systems, consulting to the whole org. And, you know, you've got a lot of depth of insight and just are a really good human. So I'm really excited to talk to you today. I'd love maybe if you just want to start by talking about your journey of how you got here to being a managing partner at Evolution and just a little bit of your story.
Well, thank you for that nice intro. I was 13 when people told me to become a business psychologist. And so multiple different people who didn't know each other said to me when I was 13 years old. And I think that was because my dad was into community building activities and initiatives. And so he would go to these meetings and
Can I just interrupt quickly? Yeah. 13-year-olds were using the word business psychologist?
No. Adults were telling me.
Oh, adults were telling you. Okay.
Yes. Okay. I was, no other kids on the playground were telling me this. Yeah. Good clarifying question. Yeah. So yeah, I was going to these meetings. My dad would go to these meetings and I would sit in the back of the room. My parents were divorced when I was 12. So it's like, if it was dad's week, it was dad's week. And if dad's going to a community meeting, Miriam's going to a community meeting. So I think I was sitting in the back of the room and these were consensus-based meetings. And as we both know, and many of our listeners know, consensus-based decision-making is extraordinarily challenging. So there would be this conversation about something for an hour, and then they would go around and they would vote and everyone would hold up a card. Green means, yes, I'm on board. And yellow means I don't agree, but I'm not going to get in the way of this. And one red card would throw the whole thing out. Mm-hmm. And to me, the worst case scenario was going to that meeting and seeing a red card, because it meant that the whole thing meant that I had to listen to the whole conversation happen again. And that meeting might not happen again for another month. And I could feel when there was going to be a red card. I could just feel it. And so I started, I don't know, I guess talking to people on breaks, and because I could feel the energetics of this group and what was going to get in the way of them getting what they say they wanted. And so I think those were the kind of the early signs that I love human dynamics, but I also really want results. And they are so linked forever and always, they'll be linked. And so I went on to study business and psychology, and as you mentioned, go into consulting. Specifically, I worked with the Dennison Consulting. So they were Bill Neal and Dan Dennison were business professors from the University of Michigan Business School, studying the link between behavior and business results. So they studied for about 25 years before creating a consulting practice. And so they were, in my mind, the best in class in the world in understanding the link between people and business, like bottom line results. So I stalked them until they finally gave me a job. And it was phenomenal. I mean, I really thought I'd made it. I really thought when I was in my late 20s that I figured it out. I knew what I was going to do the rest of my life. because I got to swim around in data all day. And we get these questions. It was Nintendo of America would call, or JetBlue, or Clorox. They would give us a call and they would reach out to us and say, help us understand our people and the link between that and our business results. And to me, that was a dream come true. Swim around in data, try and understand the story, go to the exec team, present them with the information, and then figure out what the heck to do about it. It was such a joy. Mm. Except not everybody wanted to go through that process for the right reasons. A lot of them wanted a really pretty board deck, or they wanted to check the culture box, or they wanted to affirm their bias, and they weren't really open-minded, which kind of was crushing. So slowly it became more and more and more, I guess, empty. So what started out as incredibly fulfilling started to become a bit more rote. And right around that same time, I went through a divorce and my mom passed away quite suddenly. And in that moment, I was really having trouble figuring the difference between up and down, left and right. And I didn't know where to turn. And that's when I hired my first coach. And my relationship with her and what I learned about myself in that process changed the trajectory of my life for sure.
Thanks for sharing that and your candor. What was the trajectory that it changed to?
It changed to one of self-awareness. Because I think before that, I was really living and leading in my head. I was data oriented and I was people's oriented as well. But there was a lot of me analyzing and me being intensely self-critical and perfectionistic. And it was crippling, definitely at times. And so the new trajectory that I was set on was one where I learned to slow down. I learned to drop in and respect and appreciate emotions. And then I, after tapping into emotions, I can start to tap into my intuition and I can see things more holistically. I think strategic thinking comes from being able to access more of myself. And I could talk about it in terms of my career, but I think what's more important is just how I relate to myself and therefore others.
I love that we talk a lot about that concept of transcend and include that comes from Integral. And it's like, you don't throw out an earlier operating system. So there you were at 13 and, you know, looking at how these humans were functioning and not functioning, right? And wanting to like mobilize them to come and end. And then, you know, really being interested in the hard science, but also motivated by having an impact and again, humans kind of mobilizing and orchestrating together. And so then you have this kind of this moment that happens, I think, across people look back at their lives. It's like, I don't know how many you think, but I feel like sometimes we get like four of them, right? Mm-hmm. Or something. It's like those big earthquake-like moments in life don't happen every year. They're not supposed to.
If we're paying attention, they won't. Yeah.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. I feel like I'm curious what your thoughts are, but I feel like what is it or like what enables us as people to then maximize and capitalize on those moments to really use them for good, right? To mm-hmm. kind of evolve. What are the kind of the conditions? I mean, I have my answer for that, but I'm just kind of curious, like for you. So it wasn't just pain and struggle, but it actually resulted in something that sounds like in your case, that was quite powerful.
Yeah, absolutely transformational. Yeah. I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't known to source external support. I really don't. I probably left to my own devices. I was really just figuring out what other job I could do, or maybe what other city I could move to find another job, but it would have been such an incremental shift, right? But I think what I've learned, I'm super curious what you'd say, is that if I don't turn inward, and what we like dark night of the soul, like I'm really willing to look at the stuff that I don't want to see. And I'm really, really willing to learn about what the shadow, the yuck, the pain. I'm willing to feel rage. I'm willing to feel anger. I'm willing to feel fear. I'm willing to move through all of that in an attempt to find what's underneath it, which is my truest, most authentic self. My essence is underneath all of that. But if I'm not willing to do the deep dive, I'll never know myself more fully. and I'll just be in the muck.
I agree with that. I think it's one way of a kind of a metaphor for what you're saying, is it's like you're walking on a path and then all of a sudden a little door opens in the earth and you could go in that door and it's kind of dark and kind of scary. Right. And a lot of times what happens, right, the other four times is we're like, yeah, no, I'm just going to, you know, keep going. I'm going to move. I am going to move to across the country. And then the door shuts. Yeah. And then we continue on the path and we kind of remember it. And we're like, oh, yeah, but the door is not there anymore. Mm-hmm. But then 2 years later, the door opens again. And
yeah.
The only other thing that I was going to say, and this is, you know, what was embedded in your story, is having it contained, meaning somebody that's like holding up the walls that you can bounce off of. And so mm-hmm. coach, therapist, sage, helper, groups, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about how that structure allows you to disintegrate a bit and then come back together.
Exactly. And my husband and I, we talk about that when there's a thing that presents itself, we're like, okay, it might not be convenient. It's never convenient. It's never really like, oh, you know what I'm in the mood for is more self-discovery.
Yeah.
But when it presents itself, it's there. And so we say, okay, well, it's here now. And if we don't seize either collectively or either of us individually, if we don't take advantage of it now, it might not come around for a few more years. Mm. And usually it's louder next time.
Right.
And it gets louder right. and louder and louder and more physical ailments and so on. And that goes back to my mom. I mean, she really, I do think at the end of her life, she realized that most of what she died from complications from cancer, but she thinks, or she thought, that was from unprocessed trauma and emotions mm-hmm. and things that she never could kind of let go of, and that mm-hmm. they kind of affected her medically and physiologically. So it's a promise that I've made myself, is to not turn away. But the interesting thing is, I think most people who know me would describe me as one of the happiest, most joyful people that they know.
I would agree. So what's up with that?
Well, that's the good. That's what comes from all. That's what's underneath, right? I think being willing to take those dives, I think is the constant underneath all the other emotions, is joy and gratitude and awe of life itself, and this sense of appreciation. So the more anything else that presents itself as a disturbance in my ability to access my true self. So that's why I want to move through it as soon as I can, because it feels so darn good on the other side.
Right. Yeah. You definitely are one of the most joyful people I think that I know as well, and kind of like effervescent. I'm curious, in supporting leaders, how, like, what's your viewpoint about, I mean, man, you have so many data points about how they go through these moments and how you, I'll just say, are we, but how you support them and the degree of people that quote walk in our door and are in some transition like that, whether they know it or not. Right. Cause I always think that it's auspicious when they come in for coaching. They're always maybe it's a huge wheel transition or a little one, but they're always there. And we also work with folks that have real jobs, right? I mean, they're, you know, having to show up and be an executive and lead a big team and whatever. And meanwhile, maybe that little door is opening for them. So what's your perspective on that? Or like, how have you tracked that over your career, make sense out of it, integrate that into your work, et cetera?
I think the through line of anyone that I've worked with one-on-one is that they are wanting and ready for a transformation of some kind. They're coming in saying, I need, in order to stay ahead of what my company needs of me or what this role requires of me, I have to level up. Or they're saying, I can feel in myself there's more. I just don't know how to access it. Typically, that's the starting point. And so there's either that internal reference point and there's an external one. And most of the time, they don't know what that really means. There's just this consistent thought that they're having and a feeling that goes along with it. It's kind of like a nudge of like, this isn't the extent of your capacity. There's so much more in you. And with varying levels of angst. Some people are like, I'm super curious. Like, what would that be? I'll hire a coach. But mostly for the people that we work with, there's more pressure than that. They've maybe just raised a new round, or there's more pressure from the board or rising up from their employee base. And they're saying, I know that I need to be doing better or different. I just don't know what better or different looks like. And so typically, in order to access more space, more strategic thinking, they need to learn authenticity and effectiveness. And those are kind of the two access points that I talked about. So to be authentic, that's the inward journey. And to be effective, that requires awareness of others, situational awareness, capacity to understand the mechanics of leadership. And so that's the dimensions that we talk about, the I, we, it, of knowing myself, knowing interpersonal dynamics and the job. So that's the joy. I mean, that lights me up every time I get to support someone through that journey. And it's nonlinear, which is really frustrating and hard for some folks. And some people find it easier, kind of surrender to the process.
I think a lot of people misconstrue coaching as kind of technique or a needless reflection or introspection. But can you just talk about that space that you create and what that does and like why that's important to a leader?
I remember this moment. It was the second year of my coaching training. And I remember the teacher talking about curiosity. And I asked, how will I know if I'm being curious? And she paused because she knew me pretty well. This is year two of the program. She goes, oh, it was Miriam in her head trying to understand the definition of curiosity. And so she didn't even indulge asking the question until I demonstrated curiosity about the concept, which was frustrating and wonderful. And she said there's space basically between the question and the next thought. Like you create space. And I've held on to that and definitely know that other people, when they're experiencing that, there's a sense of permission. And so I do think that impacts people's ability to show up in coaching sessions. I also think it starts to create a model for how they can show up for others, which is even more important. Can they show up for a leader who is struggling or a team who's frustrated? And if they can't create space between their thoughts and hold that in suspension, it's really hard for innovation to emerge. It's really hard for people to feel heard, to feel seen, to feel appreciated, to become more solution oriented, because most people get stuck and we hold them there by not being able to create space. But that moment in the coaching session when they get to feel it with me makes it more likely for it to cascade into their leadership.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me, especially with startups, like space is the antithesis of how they live their lives.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's like it's the opposite of that. And so it's like the only time they get to just actually downshift and like ease into their context and their life and their head and their heart is that space that gets created that you just kind of hold. And in that place, they kind of are able to access things, is what you're saying, right? It was an idea or something about themselves or their team that they just, there's no space to do anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so after I hired my coach and all that, I went and worked in startups. And so I know that firsthand that there's no way that everything's going to get done. There isn't. Mm-hmm. There's so much more to get done in a day than there is time for. Even if we're working 14 hours a day every day, even if everybody's working 14 hours a day, there's more to do than we'll get done. And so we can't wait for the moment to present itself. We have to carve out the space. And that is a constant tension, I think, for leaders in hyper growth organizations, regardless of stage, or for startups, I think in both cases. But I think I've seen 12 companies exceed the $1 billion valuation of all the companies I've worked. I think about 12 of them have exceeded that valuation. Everyone wants it. Mm-hmm. You know what? Things aren't that different on the other side of that valuation, that milestone, than they were before, but it feels good for a moment. Yeah. But I'll say the commonality that I had seen between all of them is I think effectively navigating that tension of knowing that if I don't create the space, I can't get out ahead to lead. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's an offsite with the executive team, whether it's a coaching session, whether it's a digital detox over the weekend, some way, somehow creating boundaries so that there's space for our brains to reset and for new awareness to emerge.
That's a compelling point. And I'm curious about that. 12, you said, unicorns is, you know, what we call billion-dollar companies, right?
Yep.
And you said the ones that are successful really are have successfully navigated that tension. We're able to kind of create space. What are some of the leadership dynamics about leaders that effectively are able to kind of scale like that? You know, maybe it is cultural and you want to talk about that, or maybe it's the individual leaders that you've kind of tracked. You know, what a lot of people are really kind of interested in that topic. And so I'm just kind of curious, those kind of scale dynamics from your perspective.
I think of leadership teams as the heartbeat of an organization. I mean, we work with a lot of tech companies, not exclusively. We work with CPG, healthcare, you know, goes on and on. But I think we have worked with a lot of tech companies. So I might reference some of that in these examples. So I think of product and engineering teams as being the limbs, like the execution limbs. We have sales, we have customer support. These are the functions that help make a business move forward. So that I think of that as the extremities, but the heartbeat of an organization, that's the leadership team. The more aligned people are behind closed doors, the stronger that heartbeat. And it sends a very strong and positive signal to the entire organization and allows for blood to be kind of circulated, obviously, through the whole system. I was born with a heart murmur. So if you put a stethoscope to my heart, you instead of the thump, thump, you'll hear the thump, swoosh, the thump, thump, swoosh. Most executive teams are sending messages that sound much more like my heart than they do yours to the company. And so there's this mixed signal, this confusing sense of what matters to us, what are our priorities, how do we know what our trade-offs should be. So decisions aren't being made at the correct level, therefore more is getting escalated, and the ability to be agile is significantly diminished. I think so. Agility, the ability to move as a holistic system to respond to market conditions or opportunities that present themselves, requires alignment at the top. And without that, everything else is harder. So most executive teams, I think, are overly tactical. They haven't taken the time to figure out how do we work together to do the classic forming, storming, norming, performing. They haven't moved through that process consciously. And so therefore, they're kind of, it's like the lowest common denominator in terms of how they're relating to one another. Whoever in the room is least able to access their self-awareness and make clear requests of one another, suggestions of how to work together better, everybody will kind of lower themselves to that individual. And therefore, the whole organization will perform differently because of it.
I like that, the heartbeat of the company. And having that very aligned thumping and able to work together as an organism. The team is like an organism itself, is what you're saying, right? Versus just a bunch of people doing things together. I'm curious what your thoughts are on a topic that I get a lot on this, because a lot of our clients, when they're at kind of the venture, really starts to come into play really around when they raise an A round. And certainly then really the pressure mounts at the B and C rounds around who actually is on the executive team and what does it mean to have an executive team? And it's so big. And at one point there's just a bunch of managers in the room and like, that's who it is. Anybody that has a people manager is like there as a part of the executive team. And then there's this migration that has to happen to actually build the team. You see that too? I feel like it's an issue that gets faced, and then we'll do an offsite and it's like we find out that there's people that are several levels down and that it's not really a functioning executive team.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I'd say I don't know if I've ever done a first offsite with an executive team, even from serial entrepreneurs, serial CEOs, even some of those larger, higher valuation companies, that just, it takes a really long time to get to a fully, to a healthy executive team. Mm-hmm. And I 100% agree. So your question was around how to...
Yeah, well, just talk a little bit about, you know, how you see that developing, right? To getting even the right people in the room, right? And is it, what is our work, or what's the work in scaling an executive team that's, you know, associated with that versus like an extended leadership team, for example? I don't know if you're familiar with that first team concept.
Yes.
And where it's like everybody can kind of like have an opinion on everybody else's work, and we're all leading this business together, and we're not in our little swim lanes. And it really is like this tight, there's like an esprit de corps, but that really requires that people kind of commit to that. So it's not only the right people in the room, but then also I think people need to say like, yes, this is the first team.
Exactly. So that's a major pivot in mindset for most people. And when I'm talking to executive teams around this first team concept, I say basically, instead of showing up to an executive team feeling like you're representing your function, can you show up to your function feeling like you're representing the executive team? So when you think about your first team, are you thinking about the executives? And are you, can you be the voice of the executive team and supportive of the executive team when you're with your people? And if not, that's where that, again, that heartbeat or the signals start to weaken, and the capacity to move as a single system gets softer. So to get there, it's like the right number of people. It's the right types of leaders, meaning the functions, meaning you do have to make strategic decisions with the right information in the room. So either there's people in the room with that information, or there's people who, there's enough time leading up to executive team meetings where that information can be sourced and socialized. So everyone's coming in to that first team feeling like they understand the data, like how is our churn right now? And how are our numbers looking for this quarter? And how does our product and roadmap look right now? And if they don't have that coming into an executive team meeting, then it's really hard to kind of float above the day-to-day and think strategically. So then, yeah, so it's the right number of people. It's the ability to think strategically. It's the alignment related to first team. And it's the doing the work to be able to connect and understand each other. So we've, at a very simple level, what we do with some teams is operating manuals. Like, what do you need to know about me in order to understand me? We also do the Enneagram to help them understand how they're wired potentially different than one another and how to leverage each other's strengths in order to be able to kind of unleash the power of diversity of thought.
This is important, right? Because I think it's like helpful detail to like how it's done. And I just go back to what you said, this is the kind of commitment they want to do that. I'm like, man, it feels like it's a lot harder. A lot of people are there conceptually, but then it's like, it's quite hard. And kind of, I'm curious what your question of like, how do teams get in their own way? Because they all probably are like, oh yeah, we want to be a team, right? And then so, you know, maybe this question by the way goes all the way back to your origins as a 13-year-old, which you can also answer this question from that perspective.
Most of the time, it's either they individually are feeling insecure or some version of imposter syndrome. And so therefore, it's really hard to trust or respect others, or they aren't feeling imposter syndrome. And for other reasons, it's hard to either trust or respect others. Trust is easier to cultivate. Respect can be cultivated over time, but it's harder. And so finding a group of people who are willing to and capable of trusting, respecting each other, being honest with each other, moving through conflict with curiosity, those are, I think, the ingredients. And it can be taught, but most people don't show up trying to figure that out. They're so focused on the results that they're missing the whole piece of, we can't actually drive those results without first doing the work, which does go back to my personal experience, right? It's like, go through the muck in order to be able to access true innovation through pure joy, pure, because it feels so good. And you and I mean, we're on a leadership team together, and we've said this is one of the best experiences of our career, is being on a highly functioning leadership team is incredibly enjoyable. it's so much fun for us to get together and talk about goals and do strategy sessions. It's so much fun. Most teams don't have a reference point for how good it can be. So they just are used to taking it as it is.
Have you seen some examples of a like really great, high-performing executive team, and especially one that's kind of scaled and gone through these kind of initiations? Because like I will say candidly, I feel like that's rare.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's very rare.
Yeah.
It's very rare. And interestingly, it's not complex. It's as simple as looking around at the team and in any moment saying, this is our team now. What are our operating principles? How do we want to work together? How do we hold ourselves accountable to that? And having check-ins around those things. And then as someone leaves, just like you said, having acknowledging that in the group. And then again, looking around and saying, this is our team now. And then as a new person gets hired, this is our team now. And here are our operating principles. Here's how what the expectations are. Here's how our meetings are run, creating some norms. And then as someone leaves, honoring their contribution and looking around and saying, this is our team now. And it's quite simple. It doesn't mean it's easy. Again, in the mix of a busy agenda, there's a lot. There's more to discuss than we'll have time to discuss. There's more to address than we'll have time to address. So do we have the discipline to slow down, to have these kind of more foundational conversations, knowing that that will accelerate our effectiveness over time?
I'm curious, how does that work though, when you're talking about like a tech exec team and you have somebody that's in product and somebody that's in biz ops or the CFO, where you've got people that really don't know a ton about what the other person is doing, general counsel, you know, marketing, like how does that work, or how should they think about themselves engaging in those conversations, or what even is the right agenda you think for a team to have those kind of dynamic conversations, especially when they start getting to scale?
I do think it's actually an expectation that's fair to have of exec team members that they have appropriate level of context of all areas of business. And so it's high level. It's like, what are this quarter's OKRs and are you on track? You know, it does not have to be in the weeds, but everybody, even general counsel, should know what's going on with sales and what's going on with product and all of the areas of the business. And so that's where asynchronous systems and just lines of sight come into play, especially with larger systems. Like, how do we build that so it's easy? We want to make it easy. And then, yeah, that frees everyone else up to come in and say, this is what I'm concerned. I don't feel well. I'm waking up at night thinking about our sales numbers. And maybe that person's not informed and everything's okay. Or maybe that's an early signal that needs to be paid attention to. So validating everybody's perspective, making space for people to share, I think gets us a lot of the way there. Something else we have going on though, and so I always, people say, why are you at Evolution? I'm like, it's the best. It's the great people. We have high expectations of ourselves in terms of what we deliver to clients, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. We know what matters and we know what doesn't, and we don't get them too confused most of the time.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah, laughter and kind of silliness and non sequiturs and just like people being people. And I really think, I don't know if you have a sense of this, but you can almost feel there's a feeling that's associated with high performing teams. Mm-hmm. And it is that there's like a joy in working together. There's an energy there. It just like the energy moves quickly from like what is like trivial maybe and informal to something that's really formal and deep. And you can kind of just track that. And I think like, you know, that's what you're talking a little bit about. It's magic almost.
Oh yeah.
And how to create that. It's like, that is the secret. That's the big question. How to create that magic.
Oh, that's the ongoing experiment. That's what I friggin' love. I mean, I love it. I was just in another offsite last week and it was just, let's just say, a team that hasn't quite, they're far away from what we're describing. They're very, very far away. And so to what you were saying earlier on how much I enjoy it, like I just savor at that experiment of what are the pieces here and how can we rearrange these well-intended humans and the way that they're interacting with one another to unlock that potential, which everybody wants. So what is the shortest path to get there? Mm-hmm. And that's the work. That's the most, that's what I love. That's the passion. That's for me, everything.
In some ways, I just go back to something else you said, that the muck, that the getting in and digging in builds like what, intimacy or releases energy? Is it the same principle as like, if you don't let in the grief, you don't let in the joy, like to what part of building a team is involved with dissonance and being authentic about the stuff that's less comfortable to talk about?
I think the version of that in an executive team is saying, I'm really frustrated with you right now, or I feel like you're falling behind, or that this mm-hmm. is two quarters in a row where you're missing your targets and we're not talking about it. Or every time we're in a meeting, I feel like you're distracted and that makes me feel disrespected, right? That's the level of honesty that's very appropriate. It's very professional. It's very necessary. And so that's the version of muck, I think, with executive teams. And that's part of that storming phase of being able to get comfortable in the uncomfortable. It's also dissonance as it relates to strategy and being able to push through it and continuing to build off of each other's idea. And not, I think, very high functioning executive teams rarely land somewhere that everyone doesn't feel good at. Every once in a while, it's necessary to disagree and commit, for sure. But everyone's like, yeah, I see how we got here.
The other thing that I was just thinking of as you're talking is like, I feel like in Silicon Valley, especially, there's this like single person standing on top of the hill mental model. It's like the entrepreneur, and it's like very, very solo. And one of the things that strikes me is that like the end product of a group, of a team discussion, is so much better when all voices get in there. It's way more complex and nuanced and well primed to the market than just one person, the one solo brilliant person. Yeah. And that's the promise, I think, is the companies that scale. I mean, I think at Evolution, all the times that I've gotten a piece of input that I'm like, well, thank God somebody said that, because that could have been bad, you know, at the worst, and at best it like opens up a possibility or whatever. So
yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
What in just like in closing, this has been a really great conversation. I love the linkage of like your story as an individual and your individual transformation and how that links to really building groups who are having an impact. But like, what thoughts or advice would you give for people as they're considering, you know, scaling and building an executive leadership team? Anything, mm-hmm. maybe we talked about it, but I'm just curious in closing, if you have any, you know, parting thoughts.
Yeah, I think the easy, I'm gonna come up with this on the spot. Let's see, the easy 1, 2, 3. If what do you do to create a great executive team? Number one, look in the mirror. Can you show up with curiosity? Mm. Number two, are you ready to do what might feel like slowing down in order to speed up? And if you can say yes to that, then go for it and make space in your next executive team meeting to start the conversation around how do we want to relate to each other and what will it take for us to get to a first team mentality.
It's great. Well, I really appreciate you as a human and as a partner and a friend and co-leader and all of that, and really great, rich thoughts here kind of all around. And, you know, I've definitely in my mind already have a kind of a part 2 and 3 conversation. So we'll have to schedule those.
Ooh, let's do it. Yes.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Thanks a lot.
Bells on. Thank you, Matt.
All right, Mary.
Great. Appreciate it.